You are listening to Powder Radio. Brought to you by Powder Magazine. Welcome to Sponsored. I'm your host, Mike Powell, and this week we have the most legendary filmmaker in all of skiing on the program. He's famous for The Maltese Flamingo, Blizzard of Oz, License to Thrill. I am talking about Greg Stump. He's one of the most eccentric people in the ski industry. He started his career off as a professional skier, worked his way into the movies, and then started creating his own films. Greg changed the way that movies look and sound for a generation of skiers, and we're going to talk to him about the process of creating those films and all that went on throughout his career.
Mr. Powell.
Stump, how you doing?
I am very well, thank you. How are you, sir?
I'm excellent. I can't complain. It's a Friday here in Seattle, and it's not raining. What's been going on in your world, my man?
We sold a place in Idaho, and we moved to Prineville, Central Oregon, and we are renovating her grandmother's old kind of artist house slash doll factory.
Huh. Interesting.
It is.
So how long does that project take you?
Well, I first looked at the place in August of last summer, like a year and a half ago, and then we moved here in December, and we rented for a while, and now we, you know, it's going to take a couple of years to really get it all done, because I'm still in the process of selling my Whistler condo, so I won't have that money for probably 3 months or so. But once I get that, then we'll have the juice to work a little quicker.
Cool. And you say dollhouse. What is that? What does that mean?
Well, she made dolls, so she had kilns, and I mean, there's still probably 500 molds here. Yeah. So she was a very accomplished artist, doll maker.
All right. Well, I think we should stop talking about dolls and start talking about skiing.
Okay. Are you recording?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm going to record the whole time, and then I'll cut all this stuff up.
Okay.
Well, I thank you for jumping on the call. You are a legendary filmmaker within the ski industry. The movies that you made really changed the way that people looked at filmmaking, not only in skiing, but in all of action sports. The music and a bunch of different elements that you brought into the movies really changed the game. But I think what people don't know about you is you were actually a skier first, and a pretty damn good one. And I think you were born in San Diego, then moved to Maine. And how did you get into skiing?
Well, yeah, I was born in San Diego. And my dad lived there, and my grandmother lived there. And we moved first to Indiana, because my dad was completing his PhD in theater history at IU. And we had a family vote. We were going to go to Maine and learn to ski, or we were going to move to Arizona and get really tan. And the family vote was to move to Maine and learn to ski. And that was a big part of the draw of going to Maine. So I started skiing I think I was 7 or 8 years old. And we started competing in what was called the Junior Ski Masters, which was a kids competition, which was very similar in the early stages to what PSIA certification is.
Okay.
But it was for kids. So you did your final forms, you know, you did your vadeling and your parallel turns and your short swing, snowplow, stem Christie. So you get judged on all your final forms. It's like a PSI instructor. I don't know if they still do that, but they used to. And then we had a free run that you could do all your final forms in the free run, but you could also do tricks. You're allowed to do tricks. That was the early stages of ski competition. And that was before the pro freestyle thing, too. So I maintain that these free runs were actually the beginning of organized freestyle competition.
Okay, and what year is this?
This would be 69, 70.
Okay.
And the first contest at Waterville was 71.
Yep.
So this was happening before the pro freestyle ever. The director of the ski school at Pleasant Mountain in Bridgeton, Maine, was a Swiss guy named Rudy Wirsch.
Okay.
And Rudy used to be called the Clown Prince of Skiing. Like, he used to ski on stilts, and he did tricks. He did the Royal Christies and crossovers, and he was the ski school director. And we had a couple other Swiss guys, and they were familiar with, like, Dr. Royale, who started the Royal Christie and all that kind of stuff. So we were doing tricks and free runs in, like, 69. And
then that full movement really starts in, what, 1970, 71, like you say, the Waterville contest, but the Bobby Burnses out there are really getting noticed in 69, 70?
Yeah, it was like, really 70, 71. And that's when, you know, after the pros started having the three-event format, ballet, moguls, and aerials, then the amateur competitions kind of followed, and the junior masters thing evolved into three-event freestyle skiing. So that's what we were always competing in. Well, not always, but after the junior masters thing. So, like, by 71 or so, it was, you know, the three events. And both my brother and sister and I competed along with tons of kids in Maine. And we actually had a really great, you know, the kids from Maine were always winning. And at the 1978 Nationals at Copper Mountain in the men's division, from the state of Maine, we won every men's event and overall title. I won the junior ones. Peter Young won the overall. My brother won junior threes. A guy named Doug Rand won junior twos. And we killed it.
In 79, you're the North American freestyle champion?
Yeah, I was combined. I think I won ballet and moguls that year. Because I was okay in aerials, but I was really good at ballet and pretty decent at bump skiing. So I'd finish first or second in both those two events. And so, you know, if I could make the top 10 in air, then I would, you know, I could win the combined.
And at that point, did you have some people giving you some money or some product and supporting your ski habit?
Product for sure. Yeah. I was sponsored by a ski shop, I think, when I was 10.
Wow.
And then right after that, I was sponsored by Olin really early, like when I was either 12 or 13. And then Salomon. I was Olin and Salomon for a long, long time, all through competing. You know, and it was one of the reasons that I was able to get sponsorship for the ski movies. I had already this decade long history with people like Chris Hanna, Solomon and Greg Hartley, and, you know, Wayne Wong was, you know, a good friend of mine. And so I had this history of sponsorship through competitive skiing. So when I did make the call saying, hey, man, I'm going to try to make a ski movie, I could actually get product. I didn't get any money the first year or two out of the ski industry, but I was able to get product from both K2 and Olin.
Before you even get into the movies, you spent 2 years on the bump ballet circuit as a competitive skier. And what was the vibe of that time like? Was it a party vibe after the contest? You know, I spoke with Wayne Wong and you said you're good friends with Wayne. Wayne's more of the squeaky clean kind of guy, so he didn't really have that party element to him, which is respectable as well. But I think you might have had that party element and wanted to know what that was like at that point in the ski world.
Well, I didn't actually.
Really?
No, not at all. I didn't smoke pot. I didn't drink at all. I was very seriously into the competition scene, and I didn't party at all. Like, some of the kids did, but not that many. It was, you know, when your parents were there, and it wasn't a party vibe at all. I did ski pro a couple years. I think I just skied 1 year pro and World Cup, and even then, I mean, I still didn't party. So when I was competing, I was very much into training, you know, and I played soccer. Our high school team, we won the state championships a couple of years in a row. And I didn't start, but I think I was the only kid on the whole team that didn't get a scholarship to go to university. And just because my grades were so bad. But no, I didn't party at all. I really didn't kind of get more on the party scene until I started making the ski movies.
Yeah, well, I guess that makes sense. You're competing and you're trying to do well, so you're not really wrecking your body at that point. And I know after the 2 years of competing, you were able to ski in a Barrymore movie and then some Warren Miller films, which had to be pretty phenomenal for you as watching the Bobby Burnses of the world and then being able to be in a Barrymore movie. I would think that is life-changing.
It was a really big deal. I started competing in 68, 69 in the Junior Masters, and I can all through the 70s. That's all we did. You know, we just full on competitive skiing. And then after I won the Nationals in 78, Doug Pfeiffer was at the Nationals at Copper Mountain. I had a chance to meet him there. And then after I won, I called him up and I said, you know, what do I do with this? I won the national championships. What, you know, what can I do with it? And he said, well, maybe you should talk to Harry Leonard, Jerry Simon, who ran the ski shows across the country. And so I was able to, because of Doug Pfeiffer's recommendation, Harry Leonard hired me sight unseen. He'd never seen me ski, but just, you know, Doug said, this guy just won the Nationals. He's pretty good. So
pretty good resume.
Yeah. So with the 10 years of competing, I was able to get on the Harry Leonard ski shows, and that was San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, Boston.
And back in those days, those ski shows were a big deal. I mean, a lot of people went to them, and there was a lot of things going on around the shows, right?
Absolutely. And that's where I met Barrymore, was in Boston. I was able to go out to dinner with he and a bunch of people, and he'd already checked me out, and Harry Leonard and Jerry Simon had already told him, you know, see this kid because he wants to be in one of your movies. And I was quite good on the deck, you know, the revolving deck. And just from, you know, growing up in the East Coast doing ballet on sheer ice, the deck was a piece of cake. And so Barrymore had checked me out. He'd asked around if I could ski bumps, and the word was yes. Yeah, so, you know, he had me come out to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and in a sequence, and it went so well that he said, well, you know, can you get sponsorship to come, you know, to New Zealand and Australia with me that summer? And again, because of my competitive history, and this is pre me trying to do ski movies, I was able to, you know, I think Solomon gave me $500, K2 gave me some money, and I met somebody from Anheuser-Busch at the ski shows, and they gave me some money too. So, you know, I was able to come up with sponsorship money, so I didn't cost Dick anything, Barrymore. And Vagabond Skiers. And it was a great trip. And, you know, we went to Hawaii. I learned to windsurf there. 79. This is 1979. I mean,
so that's huge. I mean, you're 18 and you're going on a trip like this. It's got to be totally game changing. And you've got to be super excited with where your career is heading.
Yeah, it was great. And I'd also gone to Solomon summer ski camps in 1974. So I would have been 14, 13. And I'd met Wayne Wong and John Clendenin and Genu Fuller, Jim Stelling, all these, you know, pro skiers that were in the Barrymore movies and that I admired. They were my heroes. So I'd had that taste of kind of hanging out with the pros a little bit. And Wayne and I had friends to this day, but we met in 1974. And the next fall, he actually came to Gorham, Maine. And I got him to come to my school. Everybody got out of class. We watched one of the Solomon movies. And we had, you know, Wayne Wong was at an assembly and like we were on the front page of the Portland paper. So it's been a lifetime of whoring myself out to the media, Mike.
Well, you've gotten really good at it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So you ski with Barrymore, you ski in a couple Warren Miller films. When do you actually realize that you can make a film? Or are you thinking to yourself, man, these films are great, but I've got a vision of something completely different that the kids are going to love? Is that kind of how that comes together?
Well, it was really Barrymore, because we were 2 months on the road living together. And, you know, it was just he and Kenny Campbell shooting. So I saw that it was most of the time just Dick. But at the biggest, his crew was he and another photographer. And it was, you know, they were wind-up Beaulieu Swiss cameras that were in his backpack. So I saw the ski movies that I loved so much were actually just made by one guy. That definitely stuck in my head. And the other thing was I was working as a DJ.
Okay.
A radio DJ. And I'd started working radio in, I think, ninth grade. But at the time, I was working at WBLM, which was a really good radio station in Maine. It was one of the best stations in the country for, like, a progressive rock station.
Okay.
You know, before they got all ruined by, you know, before radio got really crappy.
Yeah.
So I knew modern music, and I could mix. And I could narrate because I, you know, was a radio guy. So when I decided to make a ski movie, I had a pretty big leg up on, you know, the sound production quality, experience and being able to narrate. That just automatically gave me a little shot out of the cannon when I did decide to try to make a ski movie. I mean, the first three movies I made, Droids, Time Waits, Maltese, and then Good to Red, all three of those movies, I made the soundtrack first.
Hmm.
The entire movie soundtrack. Laid it down at the radio station. Did my narration. Did everything. And then I went back and painted pictures to it.
Huh.
Which is completely backwards.
Yeah.
And the first time that I could afford to get a couple of offline tape decks, Sony broadcast decks, 3/4-inch decks, and I could actually do a rough edit with Wizard of Oz. So that's the first movie that I could actually do a rough edit, and I didn't do the soundtrack first, where I actually built it like you would a normal, you know, production.
So your biggest movie of all time was the first one you actually built correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, in those movies, and you've made, what, like 25 movies, Blizzard of Oz is the pinnacle of what changed skiing. I think the athletes that you had, the camera angles and the music and everything really changed the game, and it really made skiing cool. I think on the Today Show you said it was the skiers of the extreme, and that became extreme skiing. How did you recruit skiers to get into your movie? Because I spoke with Plague, and he said that you didn't really want him in his movies because you were almost scared of him.
I wasn't almost scared. I was scared.
Okay.
When I first met Plague, I mean, he was a nightmare. I love him to death. He's one of my best friends. Well, one of my best friends, but, you know, I love Glenn. But when I first met him, he was trouble. I mean,
there's a lot of arrests and drugs, and he told the whole story, so we know there was 40 pounds of mushrooms.
And I've talked to him about it before. You know, he doesn't mind me telling journalists, you know, the truth, because he was insanely crazy. When I first started making movies, I actually looked like Michael J. Fox.
Okay.
And I dressed like him. And when Family Ties came out, people kept telling me, you know, you're in a hit TV show. And I'm like, what are you talking about? But that was just so me, because I wore ties, I wore cardigans. I mean, I was Michael J. Fox in Family Ties.
Okay.
So I looked like him. I had the short hair. So Glenn was just the antithesis. You know, and I'm out, you know, telling the marketing directors at Snowbird that, you know, we're legit.
Right.
And I remember walking into the Cliff Lodge at Snowbird and smelling fucking marijuana and going, no, 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 please, 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 please don't be coming out of our rooms. And of course it was.
Right.
You know, and it was Glenn and, you know, he's up doing bong hits in the Cliff Lodge. So I had to deal with that, you know, as the business guy. And, you know, it just, he was wild. And I didn't want him around. I was scared of him. But my partner at the time, Carl Labby, who went on to build Resort Sports Network, and he's actually on Outside TV. But Carl and I worked together at first, and Carl would tell Glenn, because Play kept showing up.
Yeah, he said he wasn't invited. He'd just show up.
No, he'd just show up, and he had all the right gear. Like, he had K2, SOS Clothing, Solomon.
Yep.
So he had all the sponsored stuff we had, and he'd just show up. And I was like, how the hell does he keep knowing where we are? Right? And it was because my partner was telling him. And because he loved Glenn.
Yeah, and I think Hattrip was telling him too.
Yeah, I think Mike and, you know, everybody but me was telling him. It obviously worked out, you know, to both of our benefit. You know, Glenn wasn't even going to be in Blizzard of Oz.
How'd he end up getting in there?
Lynn Weiland broke her back in Chamonix. So it was Lynn Weiland, Mike Hattrip, and Scott Schmidt initially.
Wow.
And the very first day of filming, Lynn slams into a cat track on the Guamante and breaks her back.
Damn.
And it was really scary, you know, because, I mean, I remember being in the hospital that night when the doctor told me she broke her back. I actually kind of passed out. I banged against the wall and lost consciousness for a second because I was so scared for her, you know, and just so bummed. Oh my God, she broke her back. And then, so then we just had Mike and Scott over there, and everybody, Bruce Benedict, Carl Labby, everybody's going, you got to get Plake over here. I mean, come on, Greg, wake up. And that's what happened. I remember picking Glenn up in Geneva Airport. He had a freaking boombox and his mohawk going. And he'd already scared all the people on the plane.
Right.
Glenn didn't use a Walkman, right? Like, Glenn had a boombox that he played on the plane just to clear out the row of you know, a transcontinental flight, right, with a guy with a boombox and a mohawk.
That's just ridiculous.
I know, but it worked out, you know, and he obviously was great. And then he stayed in Chamonix after the movie was done.
They didn't want him back here in the U.S. at that point.
Well, they wanted him.
Yeah, they, I guess they did. They really wanted him.
No, they wanted him. He had a warrant. They wanted him because he'd blown off a court date. And I knew this. And I actually gave him all the cash that I had on me in Chamonix. And I said, Glenn, you really should come back to the States and deal with this. And he's like, no, screw it. I'm not going back to America. And I left him in Chamonix with, I don't know, I think I gave him $800.
Jeez.
So all I had, and I left him there. And then, you know, Blizzard of Oz came out and just immediately took off. And then the Today Show's calling and they go, we want Glenn Plake and Scott Schmidt. So I actually had to paid a lawyer $5,000 to get it so Glenn could land at JFK without getting arrested and go on the Today Show and then go to California and deal with his court date. And yeah. I mean, even Glenn's dad didn't want to help him at that point. He's like, screw that kid. He's crazy.
It sounds like you thought you had a very manageable crew over in Chamonix, because I would think when you have Scott Schmidt and you have Mike Hattrip, they're pretty manageable guys, pretty easygoing, I would think. And then you bring Plake in, and that just totally throws a monkey wrench in that. That turns out great for the movie.
Yeah, and you know Hattrip well enough that he's a bit of a Cheshire cat.
Yeah.
Mike appears to be squeaky clean.
Yeah, but he can definitely throw down.
Oh, I'll tell you. Yeah.
So you make Blizzard of Oz. That really puts you on the map globally. How many copies of Blizzard do you actually sell?
Out of our little office in Maine, I don't know how many copies it was, but by Christmas, we had $100,000 in the bank.
Wow.
But
this is 89 too, so.
Yeah, that's just selling VHS. But the thing with my stuff is it got very heavily bootlegged.
Okay.
So I was very heavily bootlegged in Japan, very heavily bootlegged in Europe. A company out of Belgium really took me to the cleaners. And so I have no idea how many they sold. But I think it was quite a bit because, you know, to this day, one of my biggest markets for the movies is England. That happened through, you know, the initial Blizzard of Oz sales, you know, in 88 when the movie came out. But yeah, I was very heavily bootlegged in Japan and England. I don't know.
Were you making a comfortable living at that point? Were you able to play with some money and have a good time?
Oh, yeah. Because the whole thing with making the ski movies back then is I was able to raise enough sponsorship money so I could make the movie, you know, pay Bruce and pay myself. And I didn't have to sell a single copy to make a profit.
Oh, wow. So that's amazing.
Yeah. So it was, you know, I mean, I couldn't raise $1,000 in the ski industry today. But back then I was able to, you know, raise between $60,000 and $100,000, go out and make the movie.
Back then, your movies were the only thing that was out there that was really cool. There was other stuff out there a little bit, but it didn't have the vibe that you created. And today it's night and day. I mean, the skiers themselves can go out and make their edits and put them on the same day. So it's tough to get money out of the ski industry for that today, but it is a totally different world. And back then they expected to pay the $60,000, $100,000 to be part of those films.
You know, it was just an unbelievable thing. You know, I didn't have to sell a single copy of any early on to still, I mean, you know, still at the end of the day, probably walk away with $100,000. I mean, I made Blizzard of Oz when I was 27 years old.
So that's a lot of money, especially back in that era. I mean, for a 27-year-old, yeah. You were a rock star.
Well, when I was 24, 25, I was making six figures. So it was a whole different world. But Mike, you know, I'll tell you, Bruce Bennett and I, we worked our ass asses off making those films, because, you know, it was film. So, I mean, my backpack in Europe when I was making Blizzard was 75 pounds. And at the time, I weighed about 145, right? But I had, you know, an Aeroflex camera with spare mags, spare cans of film, a black bag, a tripod, 12 to 240 ingenue lens, a smaller lens, a wide angle lens, batteries. You know, it was just this massive kit. And, you know, like, you know, 100-foot roll of film lasts 3.5 minutes at real time. And if you shoot slow motion, it's about a minute and a half, and then you got to change film again. I mean, it was really a lot of work.
A lot of hurry up and wait.
For the skiers, you know, yeah. For the skiers, they were always frustrated with Bruce and I, but, you know, it's because we had our hands in a black bag changing film on the side of, you know, the Grand Monte or Mont Blanc or something.
Looking back then, do the GoPros of the world owe you something? In Blizzard, you had that one helmet cam, like crazy, crazy contraption, but it captured some great footage. Do you look at that as one of the first POVs that was really done well?
Jojo Jalbert really started, and Barrymore too. They were all using, Barrymore used a Bull U, which was a wind-up, and he mounted that on a helmet. But Jalbert was the first person I was aware of that was using these GSAP cameras, GSAP, and that stands for Gun Sight Aiming Point.
Okay.
And these were developed in World War II and mounted on airplanes so that they could assess bomb damage. And that's what those were for. It was a remote camera that was out in the wing. And the company in Los Angeles, Allen Gordon Enterprises, they bought the whole supply from the government of these GSAP cameras, and that was the POV camera of choice for, you know, if you wanted to mount it on a car, for anything, and the sports guys went for it. And it was Jalbert that really started using the GSAP on the helmet mount. I think it was Chaos and Beauty, a Solomon film. But we used these GSAP cameras, and we rented for the first couple of years, and then eventually bought one. So we had a GSAP, you know, all the time. And that's, I think by Blizzard of Oz, we owned, I think, the Good, the Rev, the Gnarly, the year before, we had our own GSAP camera, and it, you know, we used it all the time. And they were, the little cartridges went into them with 50 feet of film, and probably 50% of the time, Mike, they'd fail, right? So the little claw that's bringing the film down would start ripping the film, and so no film would pass through the camera. And you can ask Glenn this. I mean, there's a bunch of cliff jumps that he did with that helmet camera where we got to the bottom and pulled the cartridge out and went, oh, man, didn't get a thing.
So frustrating.
Yeah, because these were these little hand-loaded cartridges, and you could only buy them at Allen Gordon in Hollywood. But they were fickle, you know, and then, you know, the cables would fail, and the battery would get cold. But I think the whole thing weighed about 15 pounds. So, and, you know, what does your GoPro weigh?
Not close to that. About 14 and three-quarter pounds less, I would think.
You know, I actually did a piece for Powder TV a few years ago on the evolution of the point-of-view camera. And, you know, you look at Glenn landing some of those shots in Blizzard of Oz with that helmet on his head, and I mean, it's a miracle he didn't break his neck.
Yeah, really, you can definitely see it every time. I mean, it looks just like such a heavy piece of equipment kind of jerry-rigged together, and it worked
some of the time.
Yeah, exactly some of the time.
But I mean, I love the GoPros, and I mean, it's just amazing what people can do with it now. You look at what Candice is doing. What's the guy's name?
Candide Tovax.
Yeah. I mean, his little movies are friggin' fantastic.
I mean, everything he puts together is just so beautiful. And that guy, I mean, in terms of the greatest skiers of all time, I mean, he's got to be in there based on him being able to win slopestyle contests, halfpipe contests, going to AK, and then the videos that he's putting out now that are just beautiful. It's really amazing to see that guy ski.
Yeah, I love his movies too. You know, I mean, I never thought I'd be like, I shoot. I don't even know. Well, I own some film cameras, but you know, if I were to do a professional gig, I use, you know, a digital video camera now, and I never thought it would come to that. But it's just so cool, the technology that people have today. And you know, I mean, I'm just all for it because it allows more artistic growth and development in the filmmaking.
It does, but back in the film days, you really had to be a true, I mean, not that they're not true artists today, but you had to be a technician and artist and a whole bunch of things tied in, because you did have a lot of technical difficulties. You were working with film, and there was more of an old school mentality to it, where today it's, you know, the digital age. If you have a problem, you just go on YouTube and find the video.
Yeah, I mean, but I, you know, for us, it was cutting edge, so it didn't seem like a different world. Obviously it was.
You were cutting edge then. You were breaking ground and creating new things just like the guys are today. It's just the technology they're working with is a lot better than what you had.
Yeah, it's great. And I mean, I'd love, well, you know, the GoPros, we've been doing a lot of music stuff in the last few years, working with Lucas Nelson. And we did a shoot, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago with him when the GoPros were first coming out. And we just put GoPros all over the studio and ran them remotely. And they worked great because, you know, you forget they're there.
Yep.
And so you get really candid stuff. How about that Lucas Nelson? He's his band, that's Neil Young's band now. It's Neil Young and Promise of the Real.
No way. That's pretty cool. I was thinking when you said Lucas Nelson right away, is he Willie's son?
Yeah.
So does Willie create a strain of weed for Lucas? And does Lucas like weed as much as his father? And you don't have to answer if you don't feel comfortable.
No, I know Willie's licensed his name to some company in Washington.
Oh, yeah. He's got a strain of weed.
I mean, you know, Lucas definitely smokes pot. Willie definitely smokes pot.
He loves it sounds like. Willie.
Yeah. Well, they just played Desert Trip with Neil. Like, can you imagine? So, hey, what'd you do last weekend? Oh, we opened for Paul McCartney. Me and Neil, we opened for Paul McCartney. And they did.
And so nowadays, you've kind of transitioned. I mean, you made a ton of movies, like 20-some-odd ski movies. And if people out there haven't seen them, I'd say Blizzard of Oz is the one that really changed the game. But throughout Greg's career, there's a ton of great movies that he's made with some of the best skiers in the world. But now you've moved on and you're making music videos and working with musicians. One thing we didn't hit on, and I read somewhere, was that Tony Hawk's first appearance on camera happened with you. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was Monty Flamingo. Well, see, I was sponsored by Swatch.
Okay.
Early on, Swatch Watch, right? A guy that I knew, Steve Rexhafner, who I competed in freestyle with, like, early in the 70s, he was the third employee at Swatch.
Okay.
And Steve was always ahead of his time. And, you know, Steve was always sponsored, even when he didn't do that well in skiing. And he's just a really ahead of his time guy. So Steve was very aware of the skate scene. And so he had sponsored Tony Hawk, Steve Caballero, Lance Mountain, Christian Hissoy. And since I worked with Steve a lot, so I started filming those guys. Tony was 16 the first time I filmed him for Maltese Flamingo. So that's Tony Hawk's first movie. It's not Search for Animal Chin, it's Maltese Flamingo.
Wow, that's a pretty cool fact, and I'm sure not too many people know it. So it sounds like...
Well, and it was funny, too, because like 20 years later, I filmed him again, but at this time it was for a Super Bowl commercial for Disney. I know, and I of course, he's got his rock star trailer, and I go bang on his trailer at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, I don't know if you remember me. And he goes, I totally remember you, Greg. But yeah, I was directing a Disney Super Bowl commercial starring Tony in 2000. So we connected again.
And it's pretty cool to see, I guess, both of your careers from that point kind of skyrocket, because for you, that's 1986 and your third movie. People don't know a ton about you at that point. People don't know anything about Tony Hawk. Fast forward 20 years and you are a legendary ski filmmaker and he's the best skateboarder to ever skate.
He's pretty good. And you know something that people don't know about is, you know, Scott Schmidt was a huge into skateboarding.
I did not know that at all.
You know, he's sort of lanky. I mean, he's much smaller than Tony, but he's kind of got that thing, lanky frame. And that's when you look at Scott Schmidt accelerate out of a GF turn, he gets way low, just like he did in the half pipe, and accelerates. But yeah, Schmidt was a heavy duty skateboarder. And I didn't even know this till a couple of years ago. He and I were talking, and he's like, "You still Tony Hawk?" And he's like, "I was way into skateboarding." I'm like, "You were?"
That's pretty funny. So business has been good to you. Maybe coming out of being a pro skier and getting into your first movies, you really don't know what the future is going to hold. But it turned out to be an amazing future, and you've gone on to make Super Bowl commercials, so that's the biggest venue you can possibly have a commercial. From what I've read, you have a home in Maui, a home in Jackson Hole. Where else do you have properties?
No, I sold them all.
Okay.
I'm Prineville, Oregon now.
Okay, fair enough. And nowadays, you are working on the Dollhouse project, it sounds like. What else are we going to see from you in the coming months, years? What's your next vision?
Well, I'm not doing that much film work right now. I'm working on developing this property and making this cool, but I actually started writing a book.
You should. I'm sure you have so many stories that haven't been told in the ski industry from a time that really shaped what the industry is today. And I mean, a book, I would buy it. Actually call you for a free one, but if I didn't know you, I would buy it.
I got a good title for it.
What's that?
Forrest Stump.
Nice, nice. Yeah, you got to play off the name.
But it really has been that. Like, I my life has been a very Forrest Gump thing. I've just, you know, between the rock and roll stuff and the skiing stuff.
And even just the way that that's a play off of Forrest Gump, I mean, looking at the names of your movies, you've got a lot of plays off of Hollywood movies, and this would be the perfect way to sum it all up in a book. And then that turns into a movie.
Yeah. probably get sued for it, but oh well.
Yeah, that's what the U.S. has come to.
Well, it's either that or Snow White trash.
I mean, that's a really good one, too. I mean, if Plake was going to make a movie and he wanted to call it Snow White Trash, that might be more fitting. But you know, Maine, and then you being the clean-cut guy, and then maybe you did step over to that party side at some point. I think Forrest Stump is a really good name, and while the Snow White Trash is amazing as well, I would think Forrest Stump would fit you better.
Yeah, well, Snow White Trash is a little self-deprecating, because I actually have that title for a long time.
I don't think anybody my age realizes what a great skier you were. We just see the movies and, you know, we're always going to think only of the movies. But it's nice to know that before you were out there building films, obviously, and creating the movies in the ski industry, but you're also making money off the athletes out there who are paying the price skiing. You were that athlete before that. So it's nice to know that it's a full circle thing. You've been the pro skier, you've been in the movies, and then you're able to make the movies and create some careers for athletes. So really amazing stuff what you've done.
It was a huge part of my motivation as a skier. You know, because after I skied in Barrymore's movie, he stopped making movies after that. So it was just, you know, the Warren Miller franchise. And by that time, Warren's son, Kurt, had taken over. And I had a big issue with their movies. I didn't like them, you know, because I didn't think they had the killer young skiers in them. So my motivation for making the ski movies totally came from being the ex-athlete, the ex-skier, you know, and that's why I wanted to film people like my brother and, you know, Lee Morrison and Lynn Weiland. And I wanted the young skiers because I thought the Warren Miller people were totally missing the boat, and they were.
Oh, yeah, completely.
And then you throw in the crappy music that they put in there, and it just was, you know, it just didn't work. But it wasn't working for the kids. It wasn't working for the kids.
I'm going to bring you over to Inappropriate Questions.
Okay.
And I want to thank you for your time, and hopefully we'll see each other sometime this winter. Greg Stump, it's awesome to have you on Sponsored.
Well, thank you.
So that was Greg Stump, an eclectic individual and a pioneer in skiing. He changed the way that ski movies look, the way they sound, the way they feel, and the industry owes a lot to Greg Stump. We'll have a lot more with Greg over on thepowellmovement.com. You can find Inappropriate Questions, where Cody Townsend will ask Greg three questions, and then Greg will put three questions together for next week's guest, Rachel Burks. I want to thank you for listening to Sponsored, presented by Powder Magazine. I'm your host, Mike Powell, and I will talk to you next week.